Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, March 7th, 2014. It's the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. Every Friday, two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are the three most important to people who work for the federal government. They list them in order, and they come in the studio with me and count them down on the Federal News Countdown. This week, my experts are Dan Blair, who is president of the National Academy of Public Administration. It's great to see you, my friend. Thank you,
Francis,
for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on the show today.
You picked a ringer, as you always do.
I pride myself on that.
You mentioned that.
This one is hard this week, though.
Well, we'll look forward to
it. It was hard. I was challenged this week, but I hope that I...
You met the challenge, though.
Rose to the challenge.
You did. You rose to the occasion, and we'll hit on that later on in the show, of course. And John Kaminsky, the IBM Center for the Business of Government, is here. It's great to see you, as always, my friend.
Thank you very much.
You made terrific selections as well.
Mine are very conventional.
That's okay. That's okay. Conventional's fine because he will suck all the oxygen out of the room as far as the oddball stuff.
Hardly. I know Mr. Kaminsky quite well. And,
yes.
I think you're here for a spirited exchange.
Well, that's what we like. If it was boring, nobody would listen.
That's right.
And so that's, you know, it's good to have something to spike it up a little bit. We start on the countdown where we always do, gentlemen, with
number three.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Blair, is from the GovExec, and the headline is White House backs major postal overhaul. Is the significance here of the potential overhaul, Mr. Former Postal Rate Commission person?
Regulatory Commission.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Thank you.
It's only been that way since 2006, but no one's counting.
Okay. And you're not bitter about it, obviously. Or is the significance here that the White House is getting behind this time around, Dan?
Well, I think what's significant here is the White House is bucking the postal unions, a major constituency, by backing this reduction in the days of delivery to 5 days a week. And this has been an issue. Nothing moves fast as far as postal legislation goes. I was the staff director on the Postal Service Subcommittee working for then Chairman John McHugh in 1995 and started a postal reform effort that didn't see fruition until 2006. And because of the Postal Service's financial condition, Congress again has been looking at postal reforms. And I testified with then PMG, Postmaster General Jack Potter, when he unveiled his proposals before the U.S. Senate to move to 5-day-a-week delivery in 2009. We're now in 2014, and you wonder how much money the Postal Service could have saved by this time had they been given the flexibility and freedom to do it. I think this is a very realistic proposal. It recognizes where we stand in terms of the mail today and consumer sentiments as well. It'll be interesting to see what happens between the House and Senate bills on something like this. But also the legislation also moves a little bit further in addressing the payments that the Postal Service has to do for its retiree health benefits, also the ever-changing sums of money that they have to pay to OPM to cover retirement. They overfund their retirement system right now. My only concern about this is that as actuarial prognostications occur, at some point maybe the Postal Service will underfund, and then we'll find that what will happen when they should they ever find themselves in an underfunding position?
The thing that I thought was most significant about this story, Dan, is at the end it says the president tweaked his 2015 plan to mirror some of the developments in Congress. So this is obviously an issue the White House has been paying attention to, and seems to want to accommodate what Congress's goals are here.
Well, I think that's very important. The Bush administration followed this very closely, and the Congress worked with the administration at that point to craft the bill in 2006. This demands executive-level attention and executive leadership. This Postal Service is the one agency that touches citizens almost daily. And while we may go to touching them one less day a week, it's still a very important agency in terms of communication and business and commerce. And so its financial viability is critical. Even during all this duress, I think what's important to know is that service really hasn't waned, and that you haven't had labor unrest within the Postal Service, and that even though we've seen 6 years now of postal finances very tenuous, that its core mission is still being kept of making sure that universal service is provided to American citizens across the country.
Dan Blair's third most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is White House backs major postal overhaul. John Kamensky, your third most important story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. Jason Miller's story headlined OSTP asks agencies for bold, ambitious open government initiatives. And I confess, as Jason reported on this story to me this week, and he explained what the memo from the White House said, we have a link to that at federalnewsradio.com. It sounded to me, on first blush at least, like the White House was saying, hey, go think up some really cool ideas and bring them to us so we can use them. Did I read it wrong, or did I hear it wrong, do you think?
By June 1st.
Okay, so I only missed the timeline part.
Yeah. But, I mean, actually, this is part of the overall overarching open government agenda that this administration. That's going to be one of those hallmark things for the administration, much like reinventing government was for Clinton and faith-based initiatives was for George Bush. And I think this is going to be – and so this is kind of the memo that's a second-term refresh. Agencies have had plans. They've had their flagship initiatives. And what Todd Park's saying is let's – you know, jack this up one more level. Let's go back, refresh the plans, come up with new, bolder ideas, because the first round is made some progress on. And what I thought was interesting, though, is they said that in your report back to us that's due June 1st, tell us what happened from the 2012 plans and sort of what's been the progress. So I would have liked to believe that that would be more ongoing and live, and that that would have been showcased already, as opposed to just asking agencies now for that. But what they're going to do is it's like a six-page memo, and it details out what they're asking for and a format and stuff. But I thought it was interesting that they're also asking, let's tie things together. Tell us what you've been doing with the Open Data Initiative, the Data.gov Initiative, you know, all these different, and they said, well, there's 11 different initiatives, regulations.gov, all those things, and put them together. So I think that what the White House will get is a very powerful story of what's been going on for the past few years, and also some new things that they'll be able to tout as, say, here's what we're going to do for the remainder of the administration. Well, it says the next 2 years, but probably largely the remainder of the administration.
One of the things that I thought was interesting in this memo, and I don't see it in Jason's story, but I recall it from looking at the memo when it came out, was one of the things that OSTP is asking agencies to do is to tell them how they anticipate being able to let people know the data they have in order for those people to be able to use it. And it strikes me that that's kind of asking agencies to undertake, or to plan at least, for some kind of a marketing effort. Because that's really what it becomes, is letting people to let people know what we have. It's, you have to go out and kind of evangelize to those people, or advertise to them, or market to them somehow to let them know what you've got. And that, I'm certainly not proposing that agencies can't or shouldn't do it, but it seems to me that's kind of a chicken or egg thing, because you've got to sit around and think, well, what do we have that somebody might want to use somehow, when some of the things that have become the most widely used data are things that nobody expected people would care about to start out with? So I wonder how you go about brainstorming that inside the agency to meet this requirement to give them the information that they want.
Well, interestingly, a couple of weeks ago, there was a similar memo, but not for data to share with the public. It's for data to share with other agencies. So this is not just a public sector or giving things out to the public, but
right,
it's sharing data more broadly. And so that other memo says administrative data that nor isn't shareable with the public. For example, the steps of the processing for Social Security disability benefits and sharing that with, say, VA so that they can see who's applying for both sets of benefits. Those kinds of things, and so they can speed things along or make sure things don't go awry. And so agencies are required to develop an inventory of both the public as well as the non-public data and begin finding ways of figuring out which of these things are of value and start sharing them. But you're right. A lot of times the agencies don't know about the gold mine they're sitting on. It's only other people that go, wow, you have that?
Mm-hmm. John Kaminsky's third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is OSTP asks agencies for bold, ambitious, open government initiatives. You can read it and all of our stories on the countdown this week at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by John Kaminsky and Dan Blair on this week's Federal News Countdown.
Don't adhere to a 9-to-5 schedule. Sore throats, migraines, and chest pains don't take weekends off, and poison ivy isn't too proud to show up unannounced. For true emergencies, call 911. But there are lots of reasons to go to urgent care, and they can show up at the worst possible moment. That's why our members have 24/7 access to enhanced urgent care with board-certified emergency physicians on site at 5 of our 10 urgent care locations: Largo, Gaithersburg, Tyson's Corner, Capitol Hill, and in Baltimore County. Just 4 miles south of downtown Baltimore. Add that to the convenience of having lab, pharmacy, x-ray, MRI, CT scans, and ultrasound all under the same roof, and then you've really got something. Not to mention the primary care you'll get at any of our 29 area medical centers throughout the Mid-Atlantic. Whether it's appointments in the middle of the day or urgent care way past midnight, we've got you covered. Learn more at kp.org. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by Airbus Group.
It's going to take 2 years of study and billions of dollars to overcome the loss of security to military operations and tactics that were revealed in the massive stash of documents taken by former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. That according to Joint Chiefs Chairman Martin Dempsey. He told the House Armed Services Committee the Pentagon set up a task force to determine how the documents could possibly be used. I'm J.J. Green.
Airbus Group is proud to be a leading member of the U.S. aerospace and defense industry and to support almost 250,000 American jobs every day. From large commercial airliners to modern Army helicopters, from Coast Guard patrol aircraft to border security solutions, we support our defense, homeland security, and commercial customers so they can serve our fellow citizens. One global company, one common goal, one name to remember. Airbus.
Hi, this is Jim Fleisig. Please join me on Tuesday, March 11th at 12 noon for my monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum. This month's program will focus on mobility in government, progress, and best practices. The panel includes government leaders from the U.S. Army and ATF. Don't miss The Federal Executive Forum on Tuesday, March 11th at 12 noon, right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com.
Sponsored by SourceFire, Appian, Good Technology, and Immix Group.
How is the government managing complex technology systems? Find out at the Association for Information Resources Management educational briefing over lunch on Thursday, March 13th at Clyde's of Gallery Place. You'll hear from agency executives from across government as they talk about how policy, culture, budget, and other non-technology factors affect major systems development. Register today for Affirm's monthly briefing on March 13th at www.affirm.org.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, this week selected by John Kaminsky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Dan Blair of the National Academy of Public Administration. And we are up to
number two.
Dan Blair, your second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is, Union calls Obama's proposed 1% pay raise pitiful. Colleen Kelly, National Treasury Employees Union, saying she would accept nothing short of a 3.3% raise. Now, Colleen's been a guest on this show many times, and I love having her input, but I don't think she gets the last word on this issue, does she, Dan?
No, she doesn't. I think that this will be, again, this is a political issue, and it'll be done through the political process. I just find the whole thing about this 1% increase interesting. We have a pay system that is so broken. We give across-the-board pay raises regardless of performance. We have step increases that a number of employees get. You get them the first 3 years, every other year after that for 3 years, and then every third year after that. Basically, if you meet expectations, which I think 95% of employees meet expectations, and we are fighting over this 1%, and then we have a law that mandates parity with the private sector that says that federal employees should be increased. I think that I forgot what the latest one. Maybe it's at 26 or even 30%, which is still totally off the mark. And administration after administration, since the Clinton administration, has been ignoring, and I think rightfully so, the calls for parity with the private sector based on FEPCA, the Federal Employee Pay Comparability Act. I think it's time the Bush administration tried to address this. I think it's time that we address this again. And I think that to have a rational pay system in place for federal employees, and let's call on, and I think it's time to begin that debate about what that would look like. In the Bush administration, we tried to do that with DOD and DHS, but those initiatives faltered. I think part of the reasons that they faltered was it was done on a highly partisan basis. And I think that anything involving the civil service, the successful civil service initiatives anyway, have always been done on a bipartisan basis. That's really hard in today's Congress. But let's identify what those threads of bipartisanship might be, and we might be able to begin that conversation that could culminate in legislation, probably not in the next 2 years, but in, you know, after 2016.
I think about this, at least as far as the timeline of the legislation, John, along the same lines as the Postal Service legislation that you talked about. It took 9 years. But, I mean, this is so contentious because so many people go at this different directions. Dan's old boss, Linda Springer, wanted to look at the differences and really do some kind of research and come to a conclusion about whether people in government make more or less than the comparable people in the private sector. It didn't happen. John Barry wanted to do the same thing while he was OPM director. It didn't happen. And I'm not suggesting it didn't happen because either one of them wasn't able to make it happen. It's just that complex and that contentious, it seems to me, John.
And it's not high on the agenda.
Mm-hmm. The pay scale of the federal government and the GS schedule is not a particularly sexy issue in Congress, right?
Or the White House.
Well, that's true. What are there events that would happen or that could happen that would make it that way, do you think?
I don't know whether there would be in a way, you need some sort of a crisis or some focusing point, whether it's a champion that brings this forth or whether there's an external crisis like they can't hire, you know, rocket scientists or IT specialists or cybersecurity people.
We saw this after 9/11, that there was a consensus that we need to rebuild the civil service and that there was a need for government. Government had a purpose, it was to protect us. But that has kind of waned. And I think that the idea, as you said, John, of champions, you know, I look back and I look at George Voinovich, a Napa fellow, Senator Dan Akaka. I mean, those two bridged the partisan divide and decided we're going to work hard to try to, you know, develop bipartisan legislation. Tom Davis did that with Henry Waxman. And so it's just the atmosphere in Congress doesn't lend itself to legislation, at least, but at least the ball can start rolling. I believe that GAO is looking at this and is about to issue a report on this. I know that I think Darrell Issa asked them to look at that pay disparity. And maybe that, maybe once they issue that report, then the conversation can begin.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple of potential candidates then to take their place. Senators Tester and Portman. Senator Tester's been on this show a number of times talking about various issues with federal employees. He obviously knows the issues. He has the same attitude toward the federal workforce that Senator Akaka did, values them highly. He's in a border state. He's particularly aware of the issues that various components of DHS deal with. Senator Portman, obviously, was director of OMB. So he understands the importance of the federal workforce. They are chairman and ranking member, respectively, of now the name of the subcommittee escapes me, but subcommittee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs that oversees the federal workforce. So it strikes me that that might be a good place for this new movement potentially to start.
I'd like to see that. And, you know, with Senator Coburn will be leaving at the end of this year. He's not running for reelection. And Senator Carper has shown that he has worked very well across party lines. Actually, he and Senator Coburn are the primary sponsors of the Senate Postal Reform Bill. So maybe there is this kernel which can, you know, can be cultivated and we can grow that can begin this look, a bipartisan look at fixing the general schedule system. That, you know, it was up to date in 1948, but I think we're long. That's when the building that houses NAPA today, it was built a couple of years later than that. It's undergone some significant renovations. I think the federal pay system is in need of a significant renovation.
I think
as well.
It is interesting that in this discussion, as we talk about Congress, we've named four members of the United States Senate and zero members of the United States House. Just an observation. Dan Blair's second most important federal news story of the week is headline, Union calls Obama's proposed 1% pay raise pitiful. It's from GovExec. John Kamensky, your second most important story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. It's reported by Jason Miller. The headline is Obama to propose employee training improvements in 2015 budget. Another item, as was the pay raise story, coming out of the budget request that Congress received from the White House this week. This training thing, this emphasis on training, is, I think, tremendously important because even if it never happens, even if it goes to Congress and they strike it all out, there's still a message that I see here coming from the White House to federal employees that maybe the White House hasn't conveyed for the past 4 years.
I agree. And this is a great segue from the previous story, whereas you may not be able to get traction on pay.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly should be able to get traction on training and capacity building and leadership training, et cetera. And I think that this is sort of one of those issues that is a big deal that doesn't really make the media. And that I thought was significant was that Catherine Archuleta, the new head of OPM, looks to be like this is going to be her hallmark issue, and she's going to be the champion behind it. And this is certainly something that's been an underinvestment for the past few years. I mean, she's saying we need to learn from one another about what works. That resonates with the evidence-based policymaking that's going on in other parts of the administration. She says that we need to make sure we're providing training, mentoring, and processes in place to support career development. I don't think I've heard anything quite that. And she said this before a union audience.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds like a real commitment. And I think that's very encouraging.
I think it was also encouraging, Dan, that this effort appears to be starting at the top. They want to start with the senior executive service. And it strikes me as a really good way to get bang for your buck because those are the people who are going to go and back and not just talk the talk but walk the walk. People are going to see the difference the training makes in the way that they go about their business. And that has the potential, I think, to filter down throughout the agencies.
Well, I think training provides an incentive for employees to stay. It's a good retention issue. And as we've seen from surveys, federal employees aren't all about the pay. They're there because of the public service aspect. And keeping in this training and offering training aspects like this is not only a significant retention tool, but it's also a way of improving morale within the workforce. I think what I'm glad to see the OPM director supporting, you know, leading this charge. But it's also going to have to get the buy-in of the agencies as well. know, training's come under fire, you know, in the past 4 years with those conferences that were held. And I think you need to separate the two. I think that there is a very important aspect for training, but I think that it needs to be done very carefully. But if it's done successfully, you not only help enhance retention and potentially recruitment, you also improve employee morale. And I think that should be reflected. I'll be interested to see how that's reflected on the federal employees' viewpoint survey mm-hmm. that will be administered next year.
John, I think the administration's plugged into something here, too, that is a change that I've detected as I talk to human resources people mm-hmm. across government, especially over the past, I'd say, 6 months or so, since the shutdown. Mm-hmm. And that is, I've seen a transition from people recognizing or realizing or believing that, well, tight budget times, training's going to get cut, and there's not much we can do about it. Two, training is getting cut, and it's really important, and we shouldn't just sit back and let it get cut. We should make a case for – you used a terrific term, capacity building. And that seems to be what's driving the ability of the people who are getting their money back or who are at least starting to make a case for it to go about doing it.
Well, when I was involved with the Reinventing Government Initiative 20 years ago, one of the proposals that we had made to OPM and was quickly deep-sixed – was the notion of doing what goes on in the financial management and auditing world, which is a 40 hours a year minimum training requirement. And what I thought was interesting is I saw that in the financial management and auditing field, and that in order to be qualified to continue your job, you have to at least every a year have that 40 hours met. And have OPM say something that this should be a target or a goal that agencies should provide this for every individual employee would be a one way of doing this. Now, I thought it was very interesting that last year IBM as a company put down a Think 40. You had to have 40 hours worth of training each year, and it's led by the president of the company.
Mm-hmm.
Every first Friday of the month, she leads a 1 to 2 hour seminar on something that's significant that's going on in the company. To have a leader do that just, really sends a very different message to employees that learning and capacity building is an essential part of your job.
There's a ton more we could go into here, mm-hmm. but we've got to move on because we've got the second most important federal news story of the week is selected by John Kamensky. Federal News Radio's Jason Miller's story, Obama to propose employee training improvements in the 2015 budget. That story and all of our countdown stories will be linked later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news stories of the week as selected by John Kamensky and Dan Blair when we come back on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Here's Mark Googe, CTO of the Defense Health Agency, on the mobile device management securing your agency's information, sponsored by NetApp and Accelera Solutions.
A lot of the doctors carry a big physician's desk reference. Now by mobilizing them, I can consume that data in real time. I think the social engineering has happened on the outside. It's the social reengineering we have to do in the inside to take advantage of what the business needs and can put the right IT into the right hands at the right time.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
The way employees manage their work is changing. Workers expect to be productive from anywhere, at any time, with any device. How can federal agencies meet their employees' needs while sidestepping the challenges associated with mobility? NetApp Connect, a leading mobility solution, enables users to efficiently access their data from mobile devices while allowing IT to maintain compliance and boost security. Learn how NetApp and Accelera Solutions can help your agency reap the benefits of mobility. Visit netapp.com/government.
The Greater Washington Government Contracting Awards honors leadership, innovation, and commitment to excellence of the people and businesses in the region's GovCon community. Presented by the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce, Professional Services Council, and platinum sponsors Grant Thornton LLP and Pillsbury, the GovCon Awards are now accepting nominations for the 2014 awards. Visit www.fairfaxchamber.org for more information and to nominate today.
I'm head of my agency's project management division. Took me 10 years to reach this level. But let me tell you about Jane, head of our engineering division. When I hired her out of grad school just 3 years ago, I knew she was an engineering star, a bona fide systems whiz who was bound for success. And look where she is now. All I can say is thank you, Capital College. Please send us more Janes.
Capital College offers graduate degrees in information assurance, engineering, business administration, and other high demand fields. Courses are conducted live online, yet provide hands-on, real-world based learning, as well as the effortless interaction of a traditional classroom. And classes are taught by faculty with extensive industry experience.
Janes, Jacks, or Jills, if they're from Capital College, we want them because they're perfect for us.
For a virtual info session on graduate programs at Capital College, visit capital-college.edu/radio. That's capital with an O, -college.edu/radio.
General Dynamics Information Technology Health IT Services and Solutions. Enabling connections, applying experience, improving outcomes. General Dynamics IT, gdit.com/health.
Words of wisdom from a former COSI Award winner.
Chief Human Capital Officer at the Food and Nutrition Service at the Agriculture Department, Francis McDonough.
If you can appeal to folks' basic goodness, their basic interest in seeing their organizations work, perhaps differently than you think they should, but nonetheless, at the end of the day, having them work, then you have solid foundation for making progress.
Nominate someone who deserves to be recognized for human capital management excellence. Go to federalnewsradio.com, search COSI Awards.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by John Kamensky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Dan Blair of the National Academy of Public Administration. And we are up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Blair. And you do this every time. You choose something that I look at and I go, what does this What could this possibly have to do with the federal government? And John, to his credit, he brings it home every time. So now the pressure is on.
It is on.
Your most important federal news story of the week is from the Huffington Post. It's Ryan Nakashima's story headlined, Dorian Nakamoto Denies He's Bitcoin Founder. Now, I have to admit, I'm fascinated by this story, but you got to help me out here.
Well, this is an easy one, but before I start this, I did almost bring in the story that pulled off the line that the Japanese government is advertising a position. They're advertising for a ninja to fulfill one of their department positions.
Okay.
And,
good.
I thought that was fascinating, but I couldn't quite bring it around like I could this story.
John, I think any story that involves a government hiring somebody that my kid dressed up as
a
for
ninja,
Halloween
I think
is a really cool story.
I think it's a very important position to be filled, but let's talk about
this
article.
At any rate,
okay?
Now back to the show, already in progress.
Absolutely. This is an easy one.
Yes.
You know, Bitcoin has confounded policymakers because you have this new way of exchanging money, across, especially across international borders,
mm-hmm.
but it's totally unregulated. It's, you know, it's not taxed. It's confounding policymakers. And to me, this is a great public administration story, because what do you do when technology creates something like this that completely leaps over the current regulatory law enforcement structures that are out there? And how does the administration or Congress grapple with this, because on one hand, you don't want to discourage creativity, and this is certainly a creative way of doing this, even though this gentleman says he wasn't the Bitcoin founder, and I thought that was interesting. There's a 4,000-word article in Newsweek that went on to detail this, and he came back out and said, this wasn't me. But nevertheless, on Bitcoin, I think it's fascinating that policymakers aren't focusing more on how do we implement an infrastructure that allows for better law enforcement, allows for regulation, without killing the goose that laid the golden egg. And I think that as technology progresses, and we've seen technology progressing at a tremendous, you know, at light year rate, how do we do this? And it's just not going to, you know, Bitcoin was a darling of Wall Street. I think it dropped significantly a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is the SEC going to get, are there SEC issues in here? There are just a whole bunch of different issues that to me screams out for a public administration analysis of how do you grapple with this? How do you ensure that this isn't being used by drug traffickers between Mexico and the U.S.? How do you ensure that this isn't being used to fund terrorism between countries? How do you ensure that if this is being done and it's actually generating legitimate commerce, how do you enhance that aspect of it? And so, and government's not good at this. Government usually tends to come in with a heavy hand because legislating on these things isn't easy, and a legislator's understanding of the minutiae, which it really takes, is rare. But I found this article interesting, not only because this gentleman says he's not the one who did it, but because Bitcoin's been in the news so much lately. And because of this, a lot of people have been wringing their hands like, how do we stop this or how do we get a handle on this? And to me, this is an issue for public administrators to look at and go, what infrastructures do we have in place to work well with technology as it produces new and different forms of commerce? And are we going to be able to keep pace with it? So this was an easy one, Francis. Come on.
He brought it home, didn't
he? It's not like King Richard III.
Oh, that was,
which was a,
I'll tell you that story sometime, John. That's just
a bad transition.
I can't even begin to go there.
This one's an easy one.
No, you're right. And the policy implications here are particularly noteworthy over the last couple of weeks, John, because we had the founder of a company that traded in bitcoins who they found dead and they think she committed suicide. And the company that I don't know, I don't understand all of Bitcoin yet. I'm still in the process of learning and figuring it all out.
I'm not ready to buy one.
I'm not going anywhere near Bitcoin.
You're not. It's not in your 401k
portfolio. I'm not touching Bitcoin with a 10-foot pole with my own personal finances because I don't understand it. But the one company,
just see a FERS fund around.
You know what? And I'm surprised nobody's asked for one yet because they wanted a gold fund when gold was hot, and they wanted a REIT fund when REITs were hot, and they want all these funds when all of this .com fund back in the early 2009, late 90s, and they want all these funds in the TSP when something's hot, and then these bubbles burst, and everybody's glad that nobody did anything about it. So I'm not surprised. I wouldn't surprise. Me a bit
again,
if somebody asked for
an example of why this is a good public administration story.
Now you may be
rest my case.
You might be overselling it a little bit now, but the policy implications here are obvious when Senator Carper wants to hold a hearing in the Homeland Security Committee about what do we do about Bitcoin. I mean, that's the next step. It seems to me that based on some of the things we're seeing in the news, it might collapse under its own weight before it ever gets to that. But then that speaks to another policy question, John, which is how can government stay ahead of technology at the pace at which technology is able to move these days?
But that goes back to the old story of the Office of Technology Assessment as advisors to Congress.
Yes.
Which was abolished.
Uh-huh.
So Congress does not have the access on their own staff of this cutting-edge view of what's going on and the potential policy implications.
Where do they get that short of standing up another office like that one that went away?
Right now it's ad hoc. They hold hearings.
And that's the only way to get information?
Well, that's in the science realm.
Yeah, and I'm not denigrating that as a method to get information. But
well, there are ways of getting information. The Congress has GAO. The Congress has the Congressional Research Service.
But they don't do science.
But GAO can, and they can rely on the National Academies of Science for things like this. But for help them on the science side. But it does beg that question of how do you, you know, who's advising them?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important for those committees that are doing this to have the best advice out there. You can have detailees from the agencies involved up there advising the committees and the members. But it does raise a question of who's giving them the best advice. And if you're going to be legislating in this area, especially in the technology area, because you don't want a heavy hand in this, because unintended consequences are the things that you'd want to avoid most.
Here's my favorite passage from the story, and then we got to go. It says, after Newsweek posted the story on its website early Thursday, Nakamoto said that his home was bombarded by phone calls. By mid-morning, a dozen reporters were waiting outside the modest two-story home on the residential street in Temple City, California, where he lives. He emerged shortly after noon saying he wanted to speak with one reporter only
and
ask for a free lunch.
And there's no such thing.
Like his style. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Dan Blair, is from the Associated Press. The headline is Dorian S. Nakamoto denies he's Bitcoin founder. You can read it and all of our stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. We wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown next with John Kaminsky's most important federal news story of the week. We'll be right back.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Tracy McRae. While the average age for menopause is around 50, the truth is that the timing can vary a lot. So how do you know for sure if you've hit menopause, especially if you're closer to 40 than 50? One thing Mayo Clinic Dr. Jacqueline Thielen won't do is
make the diagnosis of menopause with a blood test.
While there are things in the blood that can provide clues, Dr. Thielen says there's too much fluctuation to make a definitive diagnosis. She starts with a thorough exam and patient history, A, to check for symptoms such as hot flashes or night sweats that can help confirm a diagnosis, and B, to rule out other conditions such as thyroid disorders that can cause menopause-like symptoms. If there's still a question,
we would probably test her by giving her progesterone and trying to spur menses.
It's important to know because premature menopause can have some wide-ranging health effects. For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org.
You can scan your router for open ports. You ever done that?
No.
Called Shields Up. You go to Gibson Research Center, grc.com, click Shields Up, and it will scan your router and give you an open port report.
Huh.
And then you can actually, if you've got a bunch of ports that are open, you can actually log on to your router web interface, and you can close the ports in your router interface.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
At UPS, we take two things very seriously, your budget and our planet. It's why we've built one of the largest alternative fuel fleets in the industry. It's why we offer eco-responsible services like carbon-neutral shipping and carbon impact analysis. It's also why businesses trust UPS to provide customized solutions that cut costs and boost productivity. UPS is committed to helping you operate more efficiently and sustainably. Learn more at ups.com/gov.
When my husband got orders to PCS to Jacksonville, we only had 2 months to sell our home near Quantico and find housing near our new base. We were overwhelmed. No, make that panicked. I'm happy to report our daughter is enrolled in school and we're settled into the perfect home that we found on militarybyowner.com.
Military by Owner. With 45,000 homes listed and 2 million visitors, you can find, sell, or rent housing near any U.S. military base quickly. MilitaryByOwner.com.
Government IT acquisition professionals, don't miss this year's Acquisition Excellence. Learn tangible strategies for procurement success from top-performing agencies and join over 600 government and industry colleagues for this jam-packed education and training event. Hosted by DHS, GSA, and the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council, Acquisition Excellence will be held on March 20th at the Grand Hyatt downtown. Register today at actiac.org. That's actiac.org.
Federal News Radio's Jason Miller is on Twitter. Follow him at jmillerwfed for the latest IT and federal management news at jmillerwfed.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Dan Blair of Napa and John Kaminsky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And you're right, John. Your choice is much more conventional than Dan Blair over here, who's got to throw us a ringer every time he's on the show. Your most important federal news story of the week is Charlie Clark's story in GovExec, headlined, Obama Budget Offers a Refreshed Management Agenda. And I'm shocked, shocked I tell you, that you chose a management agenda story for your most important story of the week.
You have to depend on me.
That's right. You are nothing if not reliable. What did you see in the management agenda, the PMA, as it's released in the budget request this week? What did you like, and what could you think could use some improvement?
Well, only the headlines were released this week. Next week, the real agenda is supposed to be released, which is tied back to performance.gov and the agency strategic plans, the agency annual performance plans, the annual or the agency priority goals. All that stuff is going to be released next week. What they released this week was, here's the four main themes that are refreshed management agenda is around. And actually, these were voiced by President Obama at a cabinet meeting back in July. And so what OMB has been doing since then is working with the agencies to flesh this out. So the four themes are effectiveness, efficiency, economic drivers, and people and culture. Again, people and culture ties back to what OPM Director Archuleta talked about. But on effectiveness, they're talking about making things user-friendly and Social Security and Veterans Administration, Small Business Administration, streamlining the construction permits, et cetera. In terms of efficiency, they're talking about things that we've been talking about for the past 4 years, strategic sourcing, improper payments, shared services. In the area of economic drivers, it's around research and development, open data, which we've talked about a little earlier, and the notion of being able to speed inventions from lab to market, because the federal research labs do an awful lot of invention. How do you get this stuff to market quickly? And then finally, in people and culture, it's a culture that values innovation, which is kind of amorphous, but there are some specifics that are falling out of that.
The item here that Charlie reports on and Jason reported on when he covered this earlier in the week that I think is a big deal is Charlie writes, the Housing and Urban Development Department's in the process of moving all its financial management over to the Treasury Department. That's according to Beth Cobert, the Deputy Director for Management at OMB. That's a big deal.
Well, it is a big deal, and the shared services concept, I think, offers immense potential in terms of savings. I mean, we've been going through this shared services concept for probably, 10 years now?
20.
And 20.
Start reinventing government, they call it franchise funds.
And this it makes consummate
I like that sense, name better by the
consummate
way.
Sense in terms of utilizing scarce resources about what who can do what. I remember one of the initiatives of the Bush administration was reducing the number of payroll systems down from 24 or 26?
I thought it was about
44. Down to four.
Yeah, and the idea was don't do to one because that's creating a monopoly.
Right.
What you want to do is have some
and
competition.
I think the intent was to get to two, but the four two were pairing with one another. But it's an example of utilizing who's most efficient at doing these. What I'd like to see more, though, is breaking down the stovepipes between the agencies.
Yes.
As to overlap and duplication in there.
Especially in mission support functions.
I think that that's where potential savings could be identified. Not just when I say potential savings, I'm talking about billions of dollars because there's so much duplication between departments and what they do in that mission support side.
The Defense Department is actually a lead in this because of their budget constraints that they've had over the past year. I mean, just last year, the Air Force and the Army agreed to go into a joint IT system, saving over $1 billion.
Well, it's it makes sense. It makes it's something that I think that could enjoy some bipartisan support. Those on the right might see this as a potential source of budgetary savings. And those on the other side can see this as a way of enhancing government performance and showing that government works well and can perform for the American people. You know, good government to me is not a partisan issue. And I think that these are things that can be promoted. But I think that there's ample opportunity and it's a very ripe area. The other thing that I would like to see more is, as we have, we know what the budget is going to be this year. We had the budget agreement that was enacted in January, so we know the blueprint for that, and we're seeing what we might think will be a normal appropriations and budget season moving forward. But as, you know, if we revisit these things again, or as we're looking for more potential savings, we need to look at ways of doing things differently in government. And that, you know, are these services and are these services being provided? Are they duplicative? And along those lines, I look at the GAO waste and overlap and duplication list that they come out with. And I think that provides a really strong blueprint as well.
John Kamensky, you get the last word. We're almost out of time. What do you expect to see this week as we see the flesh that goes on the bones here?
Well, it'd be part of what's called the analytical perspective, mm-hmm. and there'll be several chapters in there that will cover management, they'll cover evaluation, they'll cover IT, so it'll put a lot more flesh around these four themes. But I think the big story is going to be what happens on the website called performance.gov, where all the agency strategic plans and their performance plans and priority goals are going to be in one place, and you can see all this new stuff that's going on agency by agency. And I think there's going to be a terrific story there.
I still think Analytic Perspectives would be a great name for a show on PBS. And we could get Dan to host it, and we'll pay him in bitcoins. What do you think of that idea? You like that?
He'll get rich.
I think we should do it. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by John Kamensky, is Obama budget offers a refreshed management agenda. You can find it and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. And we will archive our countdown, our conversations with John Kamensky and Dan Blair at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Also, thank you very much for doing it, gentlemen. A terrific countdown, as always.
Thank you, Francis. John, it's always a pleasure.
It is great to see both of you. And the Federal News Countdown back again next Friday in the 4 o'clock hour, and hour number 2 of In Depth with Francis Rose coming up in just minutes on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and federalnewsradio.com.